Most of the part, most of the talk, I will give about some quantification methods or some basic tools, some biological tools about the DNA, by which we can measure some thermodynamic properties like melting, temperature, and some alignment tool for these DNA. Okay, so before I jump into the PowerPoint slides, I want to tell you some interesting facts about the DNA. As you know, DNA is the key of life, right? We get the features from our parents through this molecule. That's why we look like our parents. So this DNA, each cells of our body, they have DNA, means in the form of chromosome. We have 46 chromosomes in each cell. And they are so long that you cannot imagine. So we have trillions of cells in our body, and each cells have 46 chromosomes. If we extend or we stretch all those DNA, we can wrap up the sun 600 times. So very interesting, right? So I will start with that it's a polymer. It's a polymer of deoxyribonucleotides. And I will go into a little bit detail about this nomenclature, that why this is deoxyribonucleotides. Because when we see, if you know about the RNA, there is no deoxy. There's only ribonucleotides. So I will go over it in a bit. And it is found in the nucleus of the cell, and in plant cell it is into the chloroplast, and it is found into the mitochondria and some chromosomes. And as you all know, it carries the genetic information, right? So here is the a basic diagram of a nucleotide. So nucleotide is made of two components. One is nucleoside, and other part is the nitrogenous base. So if you see this phosphate plus nucleoside, I'm sorry, I just missed that. Okay, so this nucleoside is having a nitrogenous base and a sugar. So this is a pentose sugar with, means in here we are using ribose sugar. So this is deoxyribose, and there is a phosphate on it in there, right? So the question which comes into the mind, right, whether this means in the RNA or DNA, do we have the same kind of arrangement, or can we distinguish if this is a subunit or the mono unit of a DNA or RNA? So most of the, in RNA or DNA, we have almost similar kind of bases except one. So in that base is uracil, and in DNA we have thymidine. So when this base have these numbers like 1, 2, 3, 4, these are means IUPAC nomenclature. So for these ones, so we have at N7 position, this is N7 nitrogen. These are the carbon. And similarly for these pentose sugar, we have this C1 prime, C2 prime, C3 prime. Okay, so this is a glycosidic bond which attach that nitrogenous base to the pentose sugar. And actually, to distinguish between a RNA monomer unit or RNA subunit or the DNA subunit, this C2 carbon prime, means C2 prime carbon position, is the key point, right? If you see, there is one H, one hydrogen in here. And for the RNA subunit, instead of this H, you will see OH. So there is one extra oxygen in comparison to a deoxyribose nucleotides unit. So means when it is deoxy, means one there is less oxygen. So that's how this name came from, came for the DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid. And for RNA, it is only ribonucleic acid, right? And this hydrogen or this C2 carbon prime position is the main key area to identify whether it is a RNA subunit or the DNA subunit. So, means in most of these subunits, these two parts, this phosphate and this ribose sugar, are same. They are repeated units. So, and only these bases, means that nitrogenous bases, keep on changing when we see the different subunits of a DNA or RNA. So we have two kinds of non-nitrogenous base. One is purine and other is pyrimidine. And there are two kinds of purine and three kinds of pyrimidine, right? So actually these structures, even I don't remember most of the structure in my mind, but I know some basics, means how to identify. So if you see, though these two purine, they have two ring structure, and pyrimidine, they have only one ring structure. So that's the one way to identify which are purines and which are pyrimidines. And most of these structure, because they have ring in it, so they are planar. They don't have, means not many reactive position or not many active sites in there. And that's what we want from a molecule which is involved into the transfer of genetic information, right? It should not be, it means it should be chemically inert, right? So in purine we have adenine and guanine, two kind of base. So this adenine, only these two position, it makes double bond with its complementary pyrimidine, and guanine means G, it makes three hydrogen bonds to its complementary pyrimidine. And as I told you earlier, that when we see a DNA molecule, we will see adenine, guanine, cytosine, and thymine. In RNA, we don't have this thymine, we have uracil in there. So thymine is to replaced by uracil. Right? So, means that's how, means because everything is almost same in this nucleotides, except that's a nitrogenous base. So that nitrogenous base actually is the basic for different nomenclature involved in this nucleic acid. So if we have adenine, this pad is very sensitive, it's keep on skip. So we have adenine, and its nucleoside means base plus sugar is called as adenosine, and when the whole nucleotide is called adenylate, right, when we added that phosphate group in it. So that's how this nomenclature goes for each RNA and DNA. For DNA, if we go for this adenine, it would be deoxyadenosine, and deoxyadenylate would be its nucleotides, means nucleotide. And the same goes for this pyrimidine. So for uracil, there is no second part in here because, as you know, it is not found into the DNA. So it's a DNA, it's a polymer of nucleic acid. When these nucleic acid combines with each other and they form a long chain and in the form of a polymer that makes a DNA. So here is a basic informative structure unit for a DNA, and where we have a nitrogenous base, a phosphate, a pentose sugar, and a phosphate group in here. So this phosphate group and this sugar, actually, you see these two are attached with the two sides, with this 3', there is one more phosphate group attached in here, and at the 5' region, there is another phosphate group. So that's how this unit exchanged, a phosphate, a pentose sugar, a phosphate, a pentose sugar, right? So it's like a chain. So that is actual backbone, means this chain, actually the backbone of a DNA. Right, on which the whole DNA structure is built. And the only difference is the nitrogenous base, right? So this, actually this phosphate, which is actually acting like a bond, which is acting like a unit which binds to pentose sugar to each other. So it's called that phosphodiester linkage, because it acts as a link between two pentose sugar. The only thing is this base, which keeps on changing when it goes from one subunit or one linkage to other linkage. So here is a picture for DNA and RNA. So you will have a close look in here. Here's the phosphodiester bond with the pentose sugar, another phosphodiester bond, and base. So that's how a DNA, a polymer of nucleic acid, is being built, right? And similar in here, a polymer of ribonucleic acid in here. There is pentose sugar, phosphodiester linkage, and these bases. So only difference which you can see from here means an overview difference is the difference of thymine and uracil, right? But there is one more difference which you see in here. If you give a close look, there is one OH, right? That means this OH, because of this OH, it is ribose. Otherwise, it would have been deoxyribose. So this OH and that OH group makes this molecule very reactive, right? And absence of this oxygen also is one of the reasons that why DNA is not so reactive. And this RNA is very reactive, and RNA can be used as an enzyme, can be used for many enzymatic activity. Means it is very reactive, and for there are many research being going on involving RNA as an active agent. Okay. And that is one of the reason that RNA is also being easily attacked by other enzymes because of its reactivity. And there is one more reason, not so explained. I guess it's explained, but people, when you go to the scientific world, talk to people, they don't think it's a big reason. Because that DNA is most of the time, it is in double helix form, right? And RNA is single-stranded most of the time. So for natural reactions or for these biological reactions, if molecule is complex, it is more compact and it is not easily breakable. Reactions doesn't like to select those kind of molecules. They like easygoing, right? That's what we do over in the life. means we always choose for easy thing, right? The same thing goes for the biological systems. So we have that sugar phosphate backbone right here. And that sugar phosphate backbone means from two helix, two single-stranded DNA, when they come together, those sugar phosphate backbone binds together, and they make that Watson-Crick base pairing with each other. And those Watson-Crick base pairing is the bond between A and T, means T and A are the complementary nucleotides of each other, and between G and C, right? So A and T is having two bonds, and G and C is having three bonds. So just for the information, that first question comes in mind is these bond has some relevance into the stability of a DNA? Can anyone put some light on it? That if there is many GC bond, means G and C bonds, in comparison to A and T bonds, so what do you think? With more GC bond, DNA structure would be stable, more stable? More stable, right? It's very, very correct, because GC has three hydrogen bonds, and AT has two hydrogen bonds. And this is one of the main criteria when we go for designing of primers for our cloning or our PCR study. This thing does matter, that GC content of that particular primer. So the Watson-Crick base pairing, where A pairs with T always, and G pairs with C always. So that's why means I think DNA's structural information in way is not as complex as with the protein. Because in protein, we have 20 amino acids, and they can pair, means there is no specific pairing between those, right? So that's how there are some tools which cannot be used for the proteins, which can be used for the DNA, because there is only four, or I will say five new nucleotides or new nucleic acid. So we can create a where we can create easily a permutation and combination between those if we are doing some analysis or we are designing some tools for these DNA. Okay, so just for information, do you guys know who discovered nucleic acid?
It was discovered in pus, right?
Yeah, it was. He was a Dr. Friedrich Messer, I guess that was his last name. But he did not get recognition for a long time. But I guess the last 5-6 years, when some documentation happened, he got the recognition. He was the first who discovered the DNA, not the Watson and Crick. And I guess they just got information by friendship, so they published some paper on it. But it was Dr. Friedrich who actually discovered. And he was a very hardworking guy, and he actually collected those nucleic acid from the bandage. So bandage which hospital threw to the garbage can, he collected and discovered that nucleic acid from those bandage. That was real hard work. All right, so coming back to our presentation. So A pairs with T, G pairs with C. And about the RNA means can also be hybridized with DNA. Hybridized is a different term where two strand, two single strand can come and join together. or one RNA, DNA can go and hybridize with each other. Okay, so there is some rules for that, and I will talk about those later on when I will reach to that point. But before that, I will give you a few seconds. Can you tell the reverse complement or the complement of that sequence which should pair with this? Yeah, that A U C C G C C T T.
As a DNA or RNA? As an RNA or
DNA? Yeah, if there is U, so it should means doesn't matter. It's RNA or DNA. You just write the reverse complementary nucleic acid. So I guess it's very easy for everybody. It would be. Yeah, so I didn't say it's RNA or DNA. It's just a sequence for the exercise, right? So A will go with T, U will go with A, C, G, C, G, G goes C, C, G, G, A, A, right? Simple. Okay, so is there any question? Are you guys getting it? Happy? No happy? Not happy? DNA is interesting, even though I'm a protein chemist, but I like DNA. So now you see that, and I guess Eileen talked about the protein and its structural property on the first day, right? So you saw that how complex protein structures are. There are primary, secondary, tertiary, quaternary, all kind of structure exist in. Similarly, with the DNA also, we have all kind of structural detail in here. So normally, when we talk about the protein, there is a peptide backbone, right? So one backbone. So everything, so there is N connected with C, so we have 2 degrees of freedom on that. But in here, there's many degrees of freedom because we have a phosphate connected with a pentose sugar, right? And there is many possible rotation in here. So if you look closely in here, this is a phosphate, and here starts the C5 prime for the sugar, and this bond has alpha, this is beta, and these are the torsion angles around which means this can take the shape. So means this angle can change, they can be different from molecules to molecule, give a different structure to a DNA molecule, right? So there are so many angles, not like protein where there is only one peptide bond between N and C. So that's why these structures are more complex than a protein structure. So if I have a list of these torsion angle, but I will show you after this slide. So just like protein, if we talk about the primary structure, so all these nucleic acid, I mean all these nucleotides come after one, right? This deoxy adenine, deoxy glutadiene, deoxy thymidine, and they coming into the one after one, joined by the sugar phosphate backbone, and they make a long a strand, and that is the primary structure, right? They come one after one. As you remember with the protein, if amino acids one after one joins by the peptide bonds, they make a single one line structure, that is the primary structure, okay? So similar rule goes for the RNA in here. RNA also, it's a primary structure, is very simple, right? But when it comes to the secondary structure of these compounds, right? So secondary structure when the same means RNA. Sometimes RNA folds into the form of a loop, right? And those loop means in here you see this is a one single unit, but that folded itself and joined by those hydrogen bonds in here, and they make this loop kind of a structure. And similar in here, this pseudo knot where one the one single strand comes back and finds some complementary sequence somewhere in the RNA itself and binds a pseudo knot or hairpin loop structure. Right. Same. So there are these pair saying motif are also into the DNA also, the same kind of feeling. So now coming to a tertiary structure, right? So tertiary structure, when a compound bound it into the, takes a three-dimensional structure, right? It is bound with the hydrogen bond, but turn and takes a three-dimensional structure, that's a tertiary structure. So for the DNA, there are many kinds of DNA, but the picture in here you see about the three DNA, which are mostly found, most active DNA structure, right? And out of these three, B-DNA is the one which we normally found in the cells, right? Most of the time, is the B-DNA. So A-DNA and B-DNA are right-handed helix. So if you, this is right hand, sorry. So when you turn your right hand, so their rotation goes like this, means they are right-hand helix. So that's why, because their rotation, if I don't know if it is clear from here, if you will rotate your palm around your thumb, so that tells the rotation of these B form and A form DNA. And normally this A form DNA it means this kind of structure has been seen when RNA or some other single-stranded DNA tends to hybridize with some DNA. So these kinds of structure like A form of DNA has been seen, but it's not much seen. So mostly you will see B form DNA in cell, or if you go to any biology or biochemistry lab and you work with DNA. So most of the time those DNA structures are B form DNA. And third one is Z form DNA. It is left-handed alpha helix, means its rotation is on left-handed. And this kind of a structure means very rare, but they have been used to compare, to do some comparison study with the B form DNA when the structural based study has been implemented on the DNA. So here are, see, I showed you the figure in which I said that there is alpha, beta, gamma, delta, epsilon, zeta, and chi, torsion angles involved into the. So here is the angle given for A-DNA, B-DNA, Z-DNA, and DNA, RNA decamer. So you see how these numbers are changing, these numbers. So means for one possible sequence or one possible polymer of nucleic acid, there might be different structures available. It's depend upon how, where, in which environment that is and what kind of reaction it is involved. All right, so tertiary structure is not as similar, or this is not having as the same property as the protein tertiary structure, but there is a tertiary structure found. It means if there is one enzyme ribozyme, which actually means it is an RNA which takes form into two different domain structural conformation. And this enzyme is means it's made of RNAs. It has some proteins also in it, so it has mostly RNA in it. So that structural basis or that structural, that quaternary structure it gains because of the RNA present in there. But most of the time, these quaternary structures which are into the DNA or RNA, they are being activated or they happen when they interact with proteins or other molecules. So this is a structure, it's a quaternary structure of ribozyme. This is an RNA which catalyzes a chemical reaction in there. It looks like a butterfly, right? And this thing, I guess the line which says we haven't mentioned anything about lipid and sugar. We are just talking in here about the RNA fold, how that RNA is being folded in here. So now comes our first thinking question. So what are the major differences between DNA and protein structures? And what are the similarities? So that's the similarity. Any difference?
DNA just stays in the nucleus while the protein goes out and does all of the work.
So that's the functional difference, right? Very good. So as you know, the first difference I mentioned, there are only 5 nucleotides involved, right? A, T, G, C, U, and there are 20 amino acids in the protein, right? And similarity, I told that as Mac told, they have, they have all kind of structure, means primary, secondary. So structural means availability of all 4 kind of structural conformations. See what's time it's due. Okay, so just a review of intro biology. I guess if you have taken the intro biology course, you must be knowing about this. So I will just give a brief overview about this. We were talking about the DNA and RNA, but where are they? Where you can find these DNA and RNA? So this is a eukaryotic cell, right? And here this, I am very poor with the color, but it looks to me brown, right? So this part, yeah, some like brown. Okay, so this is the nucleus, right? So we have chromosomes in here, and most of the DNA, the greater amount is being found into the that nucleus, means in this new nucleus, okay? And with this eukaryotic cell, we have all membrane-bound organelles. So it's easy to separate these membrane-bound organelles. You can separate them, you can isolate them, right? There is a mitochondria, there is a nucleus, endoplasmic reticulum, Golgi body. I cannot distinguish which one is Golgi body in here. But yeah, it's a different, means wrapped kind of structure in there. So nucleus where the DNA is being stored. And you know, one interesting thing about mitochondrial DNA, that mitochondrial DNA means only inherited from mother. You cannot get, means mitochondrial DNA doesn't come from father. It always comes from mother. So I guess, I don't know how this is being helpful in forensic science, but mitochondrial DNA is being inherited from mother. So here is a prokaryotic cell where this cell wall, means this whole capsule, cell wall, and one plasma membrane, and this is the DNA. So DNA in a bacterial cell, or it means in prokaryotic cell, is always, means, let's talk only about the bacterial cell, it's always in the circular form, right? It's round in shape, so there is no actual end for that DNA. It's in circular form. It starts and binds to the same position, right? It's circular. And there is no separate nucleus for it, so it's all over the cytoplasm or into the cell. It's everywhere in the cell. That's why means it's easy, I guess. That's is one of the reasons that it's easy to take out the DNA from a bacterial cell in comparison to a human cell or a eukaryotic cell. So ribosome, because that also has the DNA, and ribosomes is found in both prokaryote and eukaryotic cell. So this is the round or circular DNA which is found into the bacterial cell, and most of the laboratory study we use this circular DNA or this plasmid for cloning or for further study of protein and other biological reactions. Why? Because these bacterial cells are easy to handle. We can grow them easily in comparison to human cells, because human cells or other prokaryotic cells, you need to work hard to get protein or the DNA from that. So most of the time in most laboratory, we use these bacterial cells for cloning or biochemical or biochemistry study. So that was a very pretty picture in here, where you can see actually your plasmid and some other organelles. But actual cell looks like this. It's too much crowded in there, right? There are too many, means that was a pretty refined or filtered picture where you saw the plasmid. But normally if you will see a close look or a correct look of a cell, the cell looks like that. See, where this is the nucleus. This is the nucleus where it's bound with the histones, DNA wrapped. There are proteins, some ribosomes in here. So these very tightly packed. So that gives a thought in our mind that when we do means chemical or biological reactions or some biologically relevant reactions in the lab, do we have the same environment as in the cell? Because cell is tightly packed, and when we do the reaction in the lab, we create an artificial environment by adding buffer or some salt solution in there. So, and that question is still out for debate. There are scientists who said that this environment are depicting each other, means they are similar to each other, and some are saying no. So you will see thousands of paper which say they are same, you will see thousands of paper which are saying they are not same. So this is a highly debating topic. Okay, so we started with the DNA, and we know that DNA, Mag told DNA goes to protein, right? And how? So that process in which DNA goes to protein is called, these steps called central dogma, right? Where DNA first goes to RNA, and that process called transcription, and then that RNA goes to protein, that process called translation. So what happens when DNA is ready for the transcription, it gives signal and a messenger comes to it, and that messenger is messenger RNA. So it DNA transfer message through messenger RNA, right? So it goes to messenger RNA, and messenger RNA carries that message and it converted to, means it being translated to trans in the form of transfer RNA to protein. So here is a translation going on where a ribosome is coming and transferring this messenger RNA into the transfer RNA. And that transfer RNA is converting these codons, like these nucleotides, means three sets of nucleotides into one protein. So in this process where the transcription goes, where RNA is being synthesized, so RNA is being synthesized by RNA polymerase, that's an enzyme, and the reading frame, if you remember from the DNA when I was talking about the DNA backbone, it was from 5 prime to 3 prime, right? So we always read DNA from 5 prime to 3 prime. Not we, even polymerase also reads into the same direction. Okay, so when RNA formed with the help of RNA polymerase, and that protein is formed with the help of ribosome. So ribosome attach in here, convert messenger RNA to transfer RNA, and that transfer RNA being converted to amino acid. So see, here there are three uracil unit, and here there is one cytosine U and A. So each these codes for a different amino acid. And there is a table. So you don't need to worry about if you are working in a biology lab and you think that, how can I keep these things remember? No worry. There is a table available online, and you can use that table to give the code, right? So see in here, there is a, for phenylalanine, one amino acid, there are many codes, four possible codes for this phenylalanine, right? So that's how this ribosome reads, which codes is going to convert to which amino acid. So when it starts reading that code, right? There is a sequence A, T, G, U, C, C, A, T, G, C, C, right? So wherever means that there is a method that when that ribosome starts reading that code, it can start from first nucleotide, or it can start from second nucleotide. So, or it can start from third nucleotide. So that depends on that where that ribosome sees this frame is more biologically relevant, right? So this reading means if it starts from the first nucleotide, it's called first reading frame. If it starts from second nucleotide, called second reading frame. So by this way, we can almost six reading frame. And Mother Nature knows which is good for cells or which is good for nature. And so Mother Nature chooses the one which is more relevant or which is required for the cell. Okay. So when you started with the first reading frame, it started with T. When you start with the second reading frame, L, and third also L. So out of these three, there would be one which is biologically relevant. Okay. And that which is biologically relevant is called open reading frame, ORF. If you have read about the cloning and about these polymerase, you will see these open reading frame information there. Okay, so now our second question for discussion, which is, I guess I already gave you a hint that our biochemistry experiments are normally done in aqueous buffer. Is this a good model for the inside of a cell? So, right, as I told that, this is a matter of debate. There is research in favor of this. There are research in opposition of this thing. So some people think, okay, it's a good environment if we artificially create an environment outside the cell in test tube, or some people say no, crowding in cell and crowding outside in a test tube is not the same. Okay, so a little bit of introduction about how research in a laboratory goes on in most of the laboratory, but this specific flowchart talks about a biochemistry lab or biology lab where we choose a system. Suppose we want to work with a protein or we want to work with a DNA. So if we have a protein, we know, okay, we have to work with that protein. So first we will see if that protein is available or not. If not, if that protein is not available, then we will look for the DNA sequence, right? And DNA sequence, if you know the sequence of amino acids, you can do the back translation and get the DNA sequence. And when you have that DNA sequence, you can express that sequence into the bacteria, then try for the expression. If that protein is expressing, you can get that protein and start your research. Right? If that protein is already being expressed and you don't need to do any cloning or any addition of that gene into that plasmid, it means it's first step, you can escape from first step and you can directly go and purify that protein and start working on that system. Okay. So that's how, I don't want to go into very detail in it. So here is a bacterial DNA which normally being used into the laboratory for cloning purposes. Okay. So what this DNA means, this bacterial DNA, the good thing is that we can cut that DNA sequence, add the required insert or add the particular gene which you think is responsible for the production of your protein or the kind of plasmid you are looking for. You can cut this plasmid, insert that gene into that one, and you can transform that plasmid again into the bacterial cell and grow them. So bacteria has this ability, it can absorb DNA from outside, inside, it can leak DNA into the solution without dying. So that's what we do into the when we do the cloning or when we do the mutation with the bacteria. So that ends our first chapter, in which we talked about the DNA structure, which is has the variety, like protein structure, and we talk about the chemical catalyzing enzyme ribozyme, which is having the RNA quaternary structure. We talked about the bacterial and animal cell, and some processing of the DNA, and how that central dogma, what the transcription and translation in there. And I told you, not in detail, but a little bit about the bacterial expression system, means what we do, why we express bacteria, what we do with the plasmid or DNA, which is found in the bacteria. So now, second part, I guess you would be more interested in that one. This is some quantification or some biological methods which are very useful for a biology or biochemistry lab, because these tools are being made to simplify our life, right? Our scientific life. If we have a 1,000 base pair of single-stranded DNA, right? It will take almost 1 hour to look for your particular sequence in there, right? 1,000 is too big, and it's very difficult to keep aligned yourself while reading those nucleotides on that one. And suppose you want to insert some mutation in it, right? And you have 1,000 base pair long DNA, and on nucleotide number 725, you have to insert a mutation, or you have to change that nucleotides. It's not easy when while you're using pen or pencil on a paper, right? So that's why we have several tools which are very helpful. But before that, the one thing which is very important, right, getting the concentration or the measurement of the concentration of the DNA, right? Write the protein. I don't know if Eileen talked about how to determine the concentration of protein, but it's into the same way we determine the concentration of DNA. So, unlike protein, we use microgram per milliliter or nanogram per microliter. So these two units represent almost the similar ratio, right? So if I'm saying I have a 50 microgram per milliliter DNA, it means I have 50 nanogram per microliter, right? Because 1 microgram is 1,000 nanogram, and 1 milliliter is also 1,000 microliter, right? So they both unit represent the same concentration here. So for DNA, it may be long, it may be small. So we made a rule of thumb for the measurement of DNA concentration that we multiply it with extinction coefficient of 0.02 per microgram per milliliter per centimeter. Okay. And if DNA length is not very much different from each other, means you have a DNA of 1,000 base pair and you have a DNA of 1,020 base pair, they probably will have the same extinction coefficient. It will not be much different. Normally, when we measure these extinction coefficient, we always have an error of 5 to 10%. So if you will use any tool and you will make a difference of 20 to 50 nucleotides, you will not see much difference into the extinction coefficient of that particular strand or that particular DNA sequence. So if you remember Beer law, right, where absorbance is equal to concentration times extinction coefficient times path length, right? So when you add this extinction coefficient and you have absorbance at 260, you can find out the concentration of that DNA, particular DNA. So right, so at 260, the maximum, we get the maximum absorbance, the average, we get the average extinction coefficient, which gives the maximum absorbance at 260 nanometer. So one thing which is complicated in here, which creates problem, is the absorbance as 2-AT, right? So 2-AT is for protein. We see protein absorbance at 2-AT. So most of the time, if you are purifying the DNA in your solution and you see a peak at 2-AT instead of 260, it means you have most of the protein in there, right? You can say that you might see a DNA also. Suppose you got a peak at 2-AT, okay? And this is saying 2.5, this peak reads. And you said that you got DNA at 1.5 also. So if you think there is a DNA, there's very less possibility of DNA because there is 260, and whatever the peak is, whatever the curve is, it will always read something on 260, right? So the best way is if you see a peak at 260, it means you have most of the DNA in there. So it's always better to look for the UV visible spectrum, and in that UV visible spectrum, if you have a peak at 260, it means you have pure DNA. So normally when we do experiment in lab, we keep a ratio of 2:1, or maybe 1.8:1, that's plus minus 2 for DNA and protein. So if you purify DNA and you have a concentration ratio between DNA and protein 2:1, you are very good. If it is less than 1.8, then it means most of your DNA is contaminated with protein. So here, I guess Eileen must have talked about the GB3. So GB3 is a 56 amino acid protein, and the extinction coefficient for that is 0.0016. And for the DNA, for a double-stranded DNA, the extinction coefficient is 0.02. So first question is, which is more sensitive? If here this for protein, extinction coefficient is smaller, and for DNA, extinction coefficient is a little bit larger. What do you think? Okay, so see, it's I guess something related to the. Sorry, this razor doesn't look so good. So probably, I guess I can explain. So see, this is a little bit bigger number than the other one for the protein one, right? So if we have a smaller concentration of DNA, and we multiply with this extinction coefficient, we will get a significant number in comparison to this one, right? Because this is a smaller number. Suppose if I have a 0.001 DNA and I multiply with 0.02 extinction coefficient, I will have a number. Suppose this number is X. That should be always greater than the number when I multiply this thing with the smaller number of smaller extinction coefficient of protein, right? Clear? Maybe? Okay. See, these two numbers are same. If this number is bigger than this, so of course this whole thing will be bigger than this thing, right? This is 0.016. What do you think, which will be bigger, this or this? I guess that, right? Because this thing is same, this thing is bigger than that. So of course, this will be bigger. So that's why DNA means larger extinction coefficient gives more significance, right? That's why it's more sensitive for smaller concentration, right? So it means DNA extinction coefficient is more sensitive than the protein, right? I guess you guys are not feeling sleepy. Okay, so I guess I talked about the implication here. So a similar way we have means for the single stranded also, right? So for single stranded it is a little bit higher, 0.025, right? And for 0.03, it is for DNA, and 0.025 for RNA. So as I told you that the ratio, if you have a ratio of 1.8 to 2 between your DNA and protein, it means you have purified DNA, right? And DNA is also, means DNA is more sensitive towards the UV rays, or means for the extinction coefficient, because DNA, all these nucleotides, they are contributing to the absorbance. They all have absorbance in it, right? Whether it is adenine or thymine or guanosine or cytosine, they all have absorbance. But when we talk about the protein, we are only talking about tryptophan and tyrosine, right? There are 20 amino acids, but only tryptophan and tyrosine, they have absorbance. All other are inert to UV. So if your protein is not having tryptophan or tyrosine in it, it means it would be, you will not see a peak at 280. So for those kind of protein, you need to measure at 205 or 220. Probably you will have peak. All right, so we'll not spend much time on that one. Okay. So there are many tools which can calculate these UV spectrum also. So there is one website, there's IDT, and it is Integrated DNA Technology, I guess it stands for, yes. Okay. Yeah, so in this one, if you have a sequence, or you have a sequence for your DNA, single-stranded DNA, there is a duplex DNA also. But I guess this in this one, you need to put only the single-stranded DNA sequence. And if you select this single-stranded DNA in here, put your sequence in here, click on your single-stranded DNA and calculate, so it will give you a nice UV spectra for that DNA. And you can see how much absorbance, approximate absorbance, that DNA sequence will give to you, okay? And if you want a duplex, means if you know the duplex, so you can separate that duplex into two single-stranded and just type one single-stranded DNA in here and click on the duplex DNA, and that will give you the absorbance for the duplex DNA, okay? So means that's a very easy tool you can get if you don't have a UV-Vis spectrum in your lab and you want to measure the absorbance and you know the concentration of your molecule, of your DNA. So you can use this tool and get all the information. I guess this is for a particular concentration, so you cannot put DNA concentration in here, but there are many others, like in here, DNA thermodynamics, where you can put in the DNA concentration and get the absorbance at that particular concentration of salt in it. right? Because most of the time when we work, we add some buffer. There are salt in it. There are some divalent cations in it. There are some metals available. And most of the time when we work with DNA, because DNA is a charged molecule, right? Because of phosphate, it is always negative. So even though if you will add DNA into the pure water, don't think that there is no salt in it, because it there would be. That's how that that charge is being kept in the DNA. Okay, so that was, I guess when you will click on, or when you will type this web address on the taskbar, you can get this website. And there is, it is not paid. It's just open it and use it. So it's free website, and you don't need to make any login. Yes.
So to calculate the UV reading, we need to have a DNA of particular concentration from this website?
Yeah, but means here they mentioned that if your DNA concentration is somewhere around 0.025 microgram per ml, right? But it will not make a huge difference even though your concentration is little bit higher, right?
So normal DNA which we extract, we can simply...
Yeah, you can normal. If you have a sequence, yeah, then you want a rough idea of the absorbance in it, you just throw the DNA sequence in it and you will get the UV absorbed. So this is the second tool, and it is used to get the reverse complement, right? If you have a small DNA sequence, you can do it on the paper, right? If I have a 5 or 10 base pair A, T, G, C, T, T, like this small oligonucleotide, I can do it on the paper. I can write it, okay, T, A, C, G, A, A. But suppose if you have a longer DNA strand of 500 base pair, 100 base pair even though, it's not easy to do it on the paper, right? So that's where you can use this website, bioinformatics.org.sms. You can paste, if you have a text file, you can load that text file directly to it. Or you can copy those DNA sequence and paste in here and just press submit, and it will give you the reverse complement sequence for that DNA. Okay. So these are very easy tools. These are tools to make our life easier in the lab. Right, because we have to do lots of things in the lab, and we don't want to waste our time reading that that reverse complement for our DNA. Okay, so I guess in the protein part, you have been told about the XPSI tools, which has several kinds of facility available in that, where you can count the number of amino acids in there. If you remember Prot Param in that, you can calculate the melting point, you can calculate the extinction coefficient of that particular peptide or protein in that one. So similar way, we can use XPSI for the translation, right? We can translate those DNA sequence into the protein, right? Each 3 nucleotides reads for 1 amino acid. So this tool, if I have this sequence in here and I put it on the XPSI, it will count these 3 and make that one an amino acid. It will count these 3 and make another amino acid. So actually what it will do, it will translate your DNA sequence into the protein sequence. Right? So if you want to make sure that whatever mutation you inserted or whatever gene you have taken or whatever gene you are trying to study on bacteria, is that gene giving you the right protein? So you can do the translation and check if you are getting the right protein or not. So this translation tool will be helpful to get you the correct translated version of DNA, right? Any question? Okay. And it is free. So no need of any login or no need of any payment in that one. These tools are all free. And the best thing is that it reads all six possible frames, means those reading frames. So instead of giving you one reading frame, it will give you six reading frames. And out of that, you can select, okay, if you are seeing that particular protein or polypeptide which you are looking for, and it is showing in that one of the frame, it means you did the right mutation or you are going right in that cloning or sequencing process. And these protein sequence or these protein database or DNA database are also available online and free. So any protein or any DNA, if you want to know its sequence or it's want to know its nucleotides base pair, you can search on the internet and go on these website, this Enthrase. So Enthrase is from NCBI, and you can look for your particular protein or particular plasmid in there, you can find out its DNA sequence, extract in the form of text files. You can load these text files directly to one of those tools, or you can just copy paste them. It's easy, it's not so difficult in there. So PDB, its name says protein data bank, but it's not totally protein. You can get some DNA text file or DNA sequence also from these data bank. Because I find them very easy. Just extract the text file, put on them, and you can get the translated version of those DNA sequences. Or if you want to see the secondary structure, the protein, kind of protein you are getting, you want to see the secondary structure information, that how many alpha or beta helix it could form, you can get these data from these data bank and use these Exposi tools, and you can get this information. And probably to get the picture or pictorial information about your protein or plasmid, you need to log in, I guess, because they don't do these structural confirmation immediately. They will send you through email the picture or secondary structure of protein or that DNA molecule. Okay. So now, if your DNA sequence and you want to introduce one mutation somewhere, right, and you introduced that mutation in that DNA sequence and you send it for the sequencing to Georgia Genomics, there is one company which we normally send our DNA sequence for sequencing. So, and they send back to you, and you want to confirm whether you have got the desired or the required DNA sequence or not, you can do the alignment test, right? You can run the old DNA sequence and the new DNA sequence all together. You can do alignment study, and that alignment study will tell you where that DNA sequence is different from the new one, right? So if you changed one nucleotides, right? If you change this C to T, right? This is very small, so you can see the difference, but if you have 1,000 base pair or 500 base pair, it's not easy to look for the difference. So these alignment tools are best to find out the difference in the DNA sequence. So this biology workbench I find very useful because this can do many things. It can align to DNA sequence, it can align to protein sequence also, and tell you about the mutation, where mutation has been introduced or not. So probably this thing needs some login, so you need to create an account in there, but it is free, so you can use it for free. There are many other functions available in this website, so you can use the, you can get the secondary structural information also with this biology workbench. So these all tools are very useful. See, if I have to read, I have to look for a particular sequence, right? If I have a long strand of DNA and I have to find out this particular sequence in the DNA, I can do the alignment test, and that alignment test will find out that where these sequences present in the DNA, or same way with the protein, right? So these things, means these biological tools makes our laboratory life very easy. Right, so that, I guess our next question is next discussion question. How can these data be used to make your lab work easier? So can you come up with any example? Any of you have, except Mac or any, I guess you also worked. So any of you have ever worked in any biology lab, biology or biochemistry lab? I know you were. Can you come up with any example? So I guess I told you many examples. Yeah. Just wanted to make sure you are listening. Okay, so as I told you that if we have to get some primer, we have to do some primer design, right? So primer design, primers are useful when we do cloning or we want to introduce some mutation, right? So in that case, we need to have primer to make that particular sequence or to introduce that particular mutation in the gene or into the genomic sequence. So right, so in that case, these tools are very helpful, right? I can find out the melting temperature, I can find out the, it means how many G and C's are present in that particular oligomer, right? So these things, if I have to do by my own hand, probably they will take too much time. So these tools saves my time, makes my life easier, and makes my boss happier when I give him too much time for research. Okay, so this part will talk about the DNA and its melting temperature, right? So DNA melting, this as this picture says, it is not the melting of any solid, right? It's not melting of ice where it melts, goes from one solid phase to liquid phase. This melting is different. See, DNA is duplex. It is bind with the hydrogen bonds, right? And when we melt these, melt is actually meant here denaturation, right? Where it means those two strands separate from each other, okay? So you see in here, actually picture is reversed in here where two strand, this is kind of annealing process in here. But if you'll see, right? So to melt this, how much heat we need or how much energy we need, how much work we have to do to melt this one. So we can think in terms of Le Chatelier principle, right? So what do you think? This reaction, this melting, which side is favoring addition of heat? When we add heat, right, adding energy or heat, which side reaction should favor? Which side reaction will go? Means two are the two, right?
First one.
Yeah, the first one, right, okay. It is on your side, sorry. My computer is showing on other side.
Oh, okay.
Okay. All right, so yes, because when you add heat, it separates, it melts, right? And that's how two strands get separated. So it means these melting is looks very simple in here, but when means the research goes on, it gives you lots of thermodynamics parameter, and those thermodynamics parameter are a great way of studying DNA. So lots of paper, if you will look, which belongs to the DNA, I mean, based on the DNA thermodynamics, you will see that this addition of heat or heat add these delta G and all these thermodynamics parameter start from this basic step, means from the DNA melting. So, as you all know, you told me, adding heat favors highly random systems, right? So when you add heat to a stable duplex, it unfolds or makes it unstable. Instead, means its secondary structure goes off, tertiary structure goes off, but primary structure remains, right? Primary structures is not easy to break. It's made by Mother Nature. Even though secondary and tertiary also, but that thing, primary structure is very stable. So, so see, we talked about the melting of DNA, but there is possibility that instead, when you melted, these hydrogen bond broke and it separated into the two part. But there might be something in that DNA which could be responsible for the melting temperature, right? There should be something in the DNA which makes us resist that much heat. If suppose something has a 75 degrees Celsius melting temperature, it means what could be the reason? Means, let me simplify my question. What could be the possible reason which gives it a melting point lower or higher? So in case of DNA, is the GC content, right? We talked in our first part that GC, which makes three bonds, so those GC content is the major, they are playing the major role into the stability of a DNA sequence. So there is a layman rule, I guess. This looks, means you can, if you have a small oligomer, you can calculate that a melting temperature by your own instead of going to any website or any biological tools. Just see here, each GC pair add 4 degrees Celsius to a molecule or to a strand, and each AT pair add 2 degrees Celsius, right? So if I have this, AT gives 2 degree, this gives a GC, if there is a GC pair, 2, 2, GC4, right? That's how we can keep on adding these number and we can predict a melting temperature for that oligomer or DNA strand, right? So this is the simple layman rule by which we can predict a
Up to what length that layman rule works?
Means the length you can read with your naked eyes. If it's 1,000 base pair, of course, you will not go far. Right? But there is, it will not be accurate, plus minus means 5 to 10% error. I guess 10% error is possible in that angle. But as I mentioned, it is not terribly accurate. So here is an example also for you, if you want to try at home, means how we calculated the predicted melting temperature for this oligomer or this DNA strand. So if you have a longer sequence, right, and you want to use some biological tools to calculate these melting temperature. So there is one, this into the IDT DNA, right? In that website, you can go and plug in your DNA sequence in there, and then it will calculate you the melting temperature. And in this website, you can add your salt concentration also. So because melting temperature also depends on the environment it is in. If your salt concentration is higher or low, it does matter. It will give a change of 5 to 8 in the melting temperature. So it does matter when we do analyze some biological reactions. So it gives you, when you put your sequence, DNA sequence with the salt concentration, it gives you melting temperature, extinction coefficient, and percent GC content. And these things are important because if your next step is designing a primer. Because if you are designing a primer, you should know the melting temperature of that primer, the extinction coefficient, and percent GC content. Okay, and there are tools which can predict the secondary structure of RNA and DNA, right? In here, you put your DNA sequence in the website, and they will predict you a secondary structure also in here. Like you see, it's a loop structure of RNA, which is being generated in here. So you can get, and even in XFuzzy, you have tools which you can use to generate a tertiary structure also, tertiary structure of a protein and DNA also. And I have used that one. It means that was not very accurate, but it was okay to proceed with your further study. Okay, so I will skip this page because that has not, I wanted to talk about activated RNA, which helps into the activating the viral, transviral, but I guess that is having no relevance in here, so I will skip that page. So now probably we will jump on to mutagenesis process. So all that exercise, as I taught you, normally means these tools are very helpful when we do for the cloning or mutagenesis, right? So for that, we need to design the primers in here. We want to know that if we have introduced or we replaced one particular DNA or nucleotides from the DNA sequence, right? And we want to introduce something else instead of that one, we need to have the primers, because primers are the one which carries the information or the new nucleotides which we want to introduce the already existing plasmid. Okay, so for that means this site-directed mutagenesis, where we know the site where we have to introduce, and we can introduce that particular nucleotide in that one. So that was invented by these two scientists, and they got the Nobel Prize for that also. And to get those primers, you should know the melting temperature, right? Melting temperature, if it is greater than 78 degrees Celsius, it's very good. It's good for selection of the primer. And for that, means I guess this temperature or melting temperature has been calculated with 2 millimolar of magnesium chloride and sodium chloride concentration. And GC content, if it is above 40%, it's very good, because you want your primer to stable also, right? It should be stable, a stable primer. And primer, normally, if your primer length is above 30, it's good, because means a smaller primer are not very good because they are not that stable, and they are not so specific also, right? Because if they have a small, they have that complementary sequence somewhere also. Because if I have a long sequence, there is a less possibility of finding the same sequence anywhere on the plasmid. But if we have a small, there is a possibility that it might go and attach to somewhere else also. So it's specificity. And it should end with G or C, because that makes it binds very strongly on the particular strand, right, where we want to add the mutation. So I will show you an example in here. Here I wanted to show you how to do that. So this is Agilent technology website where we can go and design the primer. So I guess the only thing you have to do, you have to just make sure you have a login in there. It's free, it's not paid. And when you will log in, you will reach on this page, which is for the quick change primer design. So suppose I introduce any sequence in here, right? And I want to design the primer for that. So I added that sequence. If you have a text file, you can upload that text file. But if you can copy paste your sequence, you can copy paste and upload that one. This one is uploaded now. So after uploading, you will see that it will read all the nucleotides in here. So there are three ways to do. If you know the site where you want to change, you can select this one. You know that you want to change this 22A adenine in here, and you want to change that one to G. So you can select in here. Or if you want to delete a region, you just click in here, select delete a region. You can click one and it will delete. Or third, you want to insert between two. So you can click on two of these and you can say you want to insert one amino acid, that nucleotide, and you can type that nucleotide in here. But we can do it all the way. So I selected this G, I selected this 2A, and click on design primer. Okay. So yeah, if your mutation is very close to the end, it will probably tell you that it is very close to the end or start.
You need to have more sequence.
Yeah, probably. This very small sequence. So yeah, that was, you cannot design for very smaller fragment, because then there would be too many, means most of the reading frame would be the same. I'm changing C to 32, so it's already C. Into A. Okay, so now it should work. Just click on design primer. Yeah, sometime when you keep playing again and again, it will probably not read the same thing. So if you are putting any sequence again, just clear the output. I'm changing 31G with T. Select this one. Okay. So when you will do the submit, you click on the design primer, you will see there are two primers. So one for leading strand and one for lagging strand in there. Right? So there are two primers, and you can take that sequence and you can check for their stability and the GC content by using that IDT website, IDT. So you can take these sequence, put on those IDT website and check if they are they are good on the stability criteria, they have a GC content in there or not. So I will just quickly go through the thing. So I guess I explained to you how to, so this is, I already talked about this, where you can get the information or the complementary strand information when you have a salt concentration. You can check the GC content also. You can see if that strand will hybridize with the actual strand or not. So that's how, with these websites, you can check if the primer you have got is going to hybridize, it has particular GC content, it is stable or not. Right, so so that's why when we have designed primer, we can go for the PCR, and PCR is polycarboxylic chain reaction, where if we have a very less amount of any DNA, we can just amplify it using this PCR. So I will not go into the detail. It has three steps. One is denaturing in this, both the strand comes off, they separate from, they melt, and then the annealing. Annealing happens when we add those primer, after primer get introduced, they elongate the nucleotide, and then again those nucleotides comes and binds with each other with the new mutation, right? So, and this thing can be, means checked, or can be done with various website or various biological tools. You can use them. I told you already many of those. And this one again, the same thing, if you want to check whether your primer or that particular oligomer is hybridizing, it's well hybridizing with the original strand or not, you can check in here. And and it also tells about the unpaired, and if I will do that, probably I will show you. I will skip these. So let's summarize everything, because I guess that the mutation was, this was just an example. So it's already the time, so I will summarize everything. We learned many advanced tools into which we can use in our laboratory to do the, to read the DNA strand to for the translation also, and we can combine that DNA and protein tool together. We have those tools in the same way by which we can study the DNA and the protein. But as I told you, the protein is a little bit more complicated, because there are protein, there are 20 amino acids, and there is only 5 nucleotides. So designing a tool for protein is difficult than designing a tool for DNA, right? So that's why probably work is going on, but there are not many tools available to get the melting temperature of a protein, which can give the prediction of the melting temperature of a protein, right? Because it's not easy for a protein. It has a complex structure. There are many number of subunits in comparison to DNA. So, but work is going on, and probably if you will keep an eye on the internet, you will see after some time, you will see some tools which can calculate the melting temperature for protein. So I guess it is time, so I will stop in here, and if you have any question. No question?
I have a question about the cost of designing the brand.
Yes.
The cost, like if I have a brand and I would like to, if I have something like that from Canon, how much is the range?
So primer, actually, you can design using that too. And those design primer are that order you can send to any genetic genomics company, and they will send those primer to you. And along with that primer, they will send you this information also, that how much GC contained in there, what the melting temperature and everything. Right. When you get the primer, you can start the PCR. Right? You can, you have the plasmid, okay? Plasmid from the bacteria. Most of the time we use plasmid from the bacteria. Right? You can have that plasmid or DNA from bacteria. That plasmid, and with that primer and some nucleotides, and polymerase named TAC polymerase, from very hot place, Thermus aquaticus, the name of the bacteria which gives that enzyme. So with these things you can add together, put on PCR, right? And PCR has all those cycles available in there. There is already designed, means programmed, right? So PCR has program which has a particular set of time designed for each step, for denaturation, annealing, extension, right? And then last, the cooling, all those steps. So they are already programmed in this one. So you need to select a particular program in the PCR, and it will insert, it will copy those primer on the actual plasma.
Answer your question a little bit more directly.
The cost.
Usually per PCR reaction, you're looking at about $10 to $15. And so that's if you order the strategy and quick change kit, it's like I think $350 for 30 reactions.
So
you have to order your own primers, but they're usually fairly cheap. I mean, they're like, you don't usually need a whole lot.
Yeah.
And so if you go with a company like Midland or IDT, I think it's like $15 to $20 per primer. And so it's not a whole lot for the primers, but using the quick change kit, or if you're going to go to New England Bio Labs and build your own, like buy your own TAC polymerase, buy your own DNTPs, that's going to be the bulk of your expense there. And then if you have, if your lab already has a thermocycler, then you're okay. A good thermocycler can be anywhere, from $2,000 to, $10,000 and up. But there's enough of those sitting around campus, I imagine, it's probably going to buy one if you don't have one.
Thank you.
Dinesh has the luxury of not having to worry about how much things cost. Unfortunately, I don't have that luxury. Do you have another question?
Can you go to slide 46, please? Go down one. Yeah, that one. So you type the sequence of the DNA you're trying to copy, or the primer binding region there?
It's about the DNA sequence, right?
Okay.
If you want to know, means your primer is hybridizing with the your DNA sequence or not. Or you are interested in knowing the complementary sequence also, right?
Okay.
So you type anything, right? Either you type that particular sequence which you got from the primer,
okay.
Right? You type, and on the down, when you will hit calculate, it will give you the complementary sequence also.
Okay, and will it give you those concentrations, like of your target and your magnesium concentration and all that, or do you have to calculate those?
Actually, these are the default number which are being set in here. So
okay.
If you know your oligo concentration, it's good you can fill in there. And you know the salt concentration, if you are adding sodium chloride in there, you can fill in there. But these are the default number, for that 0.25 micromolar oligo concentration.
Okay.
So if you know, you can put in your value in there.
Okay.
If you are not sure, you can just stay on that.
Okay.
It will give you approximate, not too far, but in within the range of 5 to 10%
Okay.
A lot of times if you order, if you order Zach Blumreich from New England Biolabs, they're going to include a buffer, 10x TAC buffer, that will have a specific concentration of magnesium, a specific concentration of salt.
Okay.
And so that will be sort of dependent on the buffer that you're using for your deliveries. Other times, it might be established with your prep. And so, if your lab has sort of a standard operating procedure that, we use DNTPs at this concentration, there's a lot of this that's very flexible. Some things that are very not, you can't really change it. And oftentimes, it's not very well documented which one or which.
Okay.
But generally, in the labs that I've been in, the DNTP concentration is basically just a stock that some postdoc made 5 years ago. And so you just basically use whatever they made.
Yeah.
And so that kind of stuff is often sort of set for you based on your lab standard operating procedure or whatever you're using on the lab.
Okay.
There are, and we do use this from time to time, the current protocols of molecular biology. They have sort of a standard PCR procedure in there that will give you a lot of the base concentrations that you want to use for this stuff. And then the other one that I guess we don't use it so much here because we just don't have the books, but they do have the library. It's the Maniatis, or at least Maniatis used to be the first author. He has a book of molecular biology protocols.
Okay.
And that kind of stuff, you'll have the concentrations of things that they recommend, then you can plug into a website like this.
Okay.
Any more question?
All right then.
Thank you.
Okay.